Hello and welcome back to Coven,
where we discuss our dream Coven roster.
I'm Riley.
And I'm Jenna, and we're your hosts.
Hello, episode 5?
Yeah, episode 5.
Episode 5. Wow. I got some new incense I'm burning that I just got yesterday.
What kind?
It's green fig. It smells like the green figs that I like grew in my backyard growing up. It's very nice.
Sounds amazing.
I've been very nostalgic lately.
Aww.
The last few days, very nostalgic.
Which California.
Takes me a little bit, but also just childhood, missing being a child. Which brings me to my magic moment, if we want to just jump right into that.
Let's jump into it. What's your magic moment?
My magic moment yesterday, I was just walking around, where was I? Like, I don't know, Lower Manhattan with my partner, and we stumbled across this garden that had a bunch of like sculptures and like statues in it, which is really pretty. We had like planned to go to a museum and then it like didn't work out, and so we were just walking around and found this place, and it was really nice. Yesterday it was cold but it was sunny, and so we just sat like in the sun on a bench for a while, and I just like closed my eyes and there was like birds chirping and like a wind chime. And I was just like so at peace. It was really nice. And it just like took me back to like being a little kid and like laying in my grandma's backyard and like laying in the grass, like at her house. And like, it's just like the same sounds. And it was really sweet. And so, so I texted her and told her that I was like thinking of her and about how I was feeling and stuff. And
Cute.
It was just nice. It was a nice moment.
Yeah. Maybe that was something that she needed too.
Probably. Yeah. So it was good to just have that little moment and have a piece to like connect with her on. So you're sweet.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good one. I love that. Yeah.
What's your magic moment this week?
My magic moment is that I put out music for
The
first time in 4 years. And nothing, it's not like a new project. It's a Cloud Baby stuff that I'd done like 4 years ago. And I was just kind of sitting on a lot of these songs that I'd never done anything with. And instead of deleting them, I was like, you know what? I'm just going to put them out into the world because I like them. And I don't know, I feel like they're not finished songs, but I felt like they were, just wanted to get them into the world. When I released it, I noticed like all of my friends who are musicians happened to release music that day, like on the same day, which it does happen all the time, but it was just like more than usual. My timeline was flooded. And then I remembered that day Mercury was sextile Neptune. And in my newsletter,
Explain that.
In my newsletter that I send out monthly, where I go over the transits, which if you want it, shout out to my newsletter, sign up.
Stars-etc.com.
You can sign up for monthly free newsletters. But I go over all the transits. And for that one, I wrote basically like it's a great day for your creativity to express yourself and do something artistic that lets your visionary side roam free. So I just thought awesome. That was fun.
Did you put the music out knowing that that was like?
I did when I set the release date, and then I forgot. And then when it came out and I noticed everybody releasing something, like kind of music, I checked back and I was like, oh, right. That makes sense.
Yeah.
So that's just like a fun little synchronistic.
I love that. I need to listen to it. I'm so bad at listening to new music, but I promise I will listen to it.
It's okay.
Check it out. Cloud Baby.
Cloud Baby. It's called the Cloud CB Baby Plug. Tapes 2020. But yeah, they're fun.
I'm excited.
They're just like silly little pop songs. Some of them are, most of them started as jokes, but.
Cute.
Yeah, that was fun.
Also plug for Jenna's newsletter, because every time me and my partner read our like horoscopes on it, he always like freaks out. He's like, what? Like, it's just always like I meant to text you last time we read like the most recent one. Mm-hmm. But I think I tell you every time it comes out, he's like, whoa, she's just like reading into my life. Like, yeah, she's actually good at her job. Oh, so
yeah. I love that.
Yeah. stars-etc.com.
That is what it is.
If you want to send us your magic moments, please do. We will read them on the air. Send us your synchronicities, your crazy coincidences, your just lovely happenings in your life to covenpod333@gmail.com, and we will read them on the podcast. Yes. Pretty please, send them.
Please send them. We want to know. Us. We'd love to get to know all of you. Yes. And to share your magic moments.
Yes.
So should we get into it? So I do not have a birth chart for this one. For at a all? Few reasons. Not at all. For a few reasons.
Okay.
One, because she doesn't have any kind of birthday, near, year, anything. Okay. It's believed she was born in the early 14th century, sometime between 1301 and 1320, but no one knows what year. So it's like, I didn't want to, there's just too much error there. Yeah. The other thing is the region that she lived and was born in is Eastern, and I practice tropical Western astrology. And I actually don't really think it's appropriate to apply Western astrology to Far Eastern cultures and people. I think Vedic astrology is a lot more appropriate, but I don't practice Vedic astrology. I don't know it like that. So I don't even like, I feel like it wouldn't even make sense to do a birth chart for this person with the kind of astrology that I practice. I am going to say like kind of the general vibe of signs that she gives me. So I feel like this person probably has a lot of Pisces placements, probably Aquarius placements, maybe Scorpio, possibly Sag, Aries, or Capricorn.
Okay.
Those are the main.
It's like half of them.
I know. I feel like there's probably a mix. A lot of Pisces and Aquarius for sure. Like those are the ones I feel strong about. Scorpio, secondary. And then there has to be something. I said Sag, Aries, or Capricorn because those are all like the side of her that's different than Pisces and Aquarius. I feel like would be the Sag, Aries, or Capricorn. And I can't decide which one of those it is.
Okay.
So what does that mean?
That's what I get. Well, like what would you think would be like in Pisces, like what, like which of her placements from like what you and like which ones would you think would be Aquarius? You know,
I could see something
to work on.
Yeah. I could see her being a Pisces sun and like a Scorpio moon.
Okay.
And like a Pisces or Gemini Mercury, maybe a Pisces rising, Aquarius, like
oh
Venus.
from your hint last week you said poet.
So
I'm remembering that.
As I feel like her Mars would be in Aries if she had Aries placements.
Okay.
And, you know, she could be an Aries moon, too. I feel like a lot of these have been Aries moons randomly.
Okay, it's like an intense, like a very intense, like, moon sign. So a very, like, intense emotional life. And but, like, either Scorpio or Aries I feel like is going to be, like, very different. Like expression of emotions where like Scorpio moon would probably would be more like dark and brooding, and I would expect maybe her poetry or her art to be more of like that nature. But like with an an Aries moon, I would expect her art to be more like, have more of like a punch to it, whether it's like not necessarily like that it would have to be like fiery in an angry way.
You saying all of that actually makes me want to make her an Aries moon. Not just because I'm an Aries moon and I want all of these women to be Aries moons because it makes me feel good. But because, yeah, I do think that her art and the way she expresses herself is really like direct and forward and like blunt. But I do, the Pisces is definitely strong because this, the Pisces, probably Sun, maybe Pisces Mercury. I could see Pisces Venus too.
It'll be interesting to see, I guess, like examples of her work and see if like the subject matter is like, with all the Pisces, like very dreamy and like still has like a dreamy quality to it, or if it's and like focused on like beauty, observing like the beauty around her, or dreaming about like beautiful things in a sense, or if it's like going to maybe, I don't know, reflect in Aries energy in a different way.
I mean, you did a great job with that very vague information.
I'll take it.
So today I'm inviting 14th century mystic poetess, revolutionary syncretist, and saint of Kashmir, Lal Dead, into our coven.
Okay, I'm excited.
Have you ever heard of her?
No idea who this is. No, not at all.
Amazing.
Okay, mystic poet. What was the other word you said?
Syncretist. I said revolutionary syncretist. Because syncretism is basically somebody who combines several belief systems.
Okay.
Several cultures. And we'll get into that.
Okay.
A little bit
later. Go ahead. I'm excited.
Yeah. So Lal Dead is what she's most commonly known by, but she, I think her actual name was Lalishwari, but she goes by Lal Dead, which translates to Granny Lal, or Lal Mej, which translates to Mother Lal, or Lala, affectionately termed. And before I get into this fully, I do want to give a disclaimer with this episode. We've said before, we're not historians, journalists, or theologians. And that's definitely true still. And during this episode, I'll be speaking about a person from the part of the world that I was previously very unfamiliar with. And I've done a lot of research for this episode, but I am still very naive when it comes to a lot of what I'm about to share. So please inform me if I have any of my information wrong, including pronunciations of anything. I am just learning about cool things and people. So that being said, she was born in Kashmir, the Kashmir region of India, in the early 14th century. So between 1301 and 1320, near Srinagar, in the Kashmir region of India. So that is the northernmost region in India.
Enjoy the comments from our co-host, Salem.
He's got a lot of opinions about this one.
Yeah, he does. He's a big fan of Lal Dead.
We love Salem. It's okay, Salem. Okay. Speak your truth.
He walked away. He'll come back later, I'm sure. Okay, so where in India are we? Set the scene for me again.
She was born near Srinagar, in the Kashmir region of India, which is the northernmost northwestern region of India. And I will set the scene and give a little bit of history in that region before we begin, because I do think it's important to understand her significance and just how incredible she was. But to give a brief overview of who she is, she's most famous for being the creator of the style of mystic poetry called Vatsan or Vax, which literally translates to speech from Sanskrit. Cool. These were transcendental, poetic, yet direct, simple, holistic, and universal lyrics. They're typically four lines. They don't rhyme. They're similar to haiku in delivery. Mm-hmm. To me, they read a lot like scripture. Cool. And in a lot of research that I'm doing, nobody's really said that. But I'm like, they call them poetry. They call them poems, mm-hmm. or speeches or something. But I'm like, why not scripture? Why not verses? Because mm-hmm. I don't know. They're not really different from other like Bible verses and things that you read. They're just like a really specific style of it.
Yeah. Is the whole thing four lines?
Or yeah, is it all like of them,
chunks each, of like four line
things? Each individual, they're like individual vox, like individual okay. poems. And okay. each individual voc is four lines.
Okay. Okay, cool. I was thinking like, is it like a psalm vibe, but those are long.
Right. A collected work.
Yeah. Okay.
Kind of. Go ahead. But we'll get into that later. I'll explain more of that later. But she's apparently super iconic and famous in Kashmir still today. But outside of that valley, not very well known.
Interesting.
Which is interesting. And I'm curious mm-hmm. in the Hindu and Islam religions, how well known she is. I know obviously mm-hmm. in Western culture, she is not very well known. But yeah, I wonder how many people would recognize her name.
Yeah,
in more Eastern mm-hmm. areas. She didn't have any written record of her life until centuries after her death, nor has anyone found manuscripts containing her vak that date anywhere from near her lifetime. So because of this, a lot of her story and all of her vaks are based on oral tradition.
Okay.
So that makes a lot of variance in stories about her life and her beliefs. Mm-hmm. This is also why I didn't want to provide a birth chart because it's just, there's a lot of mystery about it.
Right.
But we know that she's revered by Muslims and Hindu alike. And she is a saint, considered a saint in Hinduism and Islam. So that's very interesting. Cool. Two pretty different religions.
Yeah. Yeah. And cultures. Totally. It's very interesting.
Yeah. So the reason that this is such an interesting person and this region is so important is because the Kashmir region of India, it's bordered by China, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and India. Mm-hmm. So all of these vastly different cultures, Kashmir mm-hmm. is kind of right in the middle, like the buffer mm-hmm. between them. Its geography is predominantly mountains with deep, narrow valleys and high, barren plateaus. So basically gorgeous, paradise-looking land.
I'm sure.
And it was ruled by a succession of Hindu dynasties up to 1346. So in 1346, it came under Muslim rule. Mm. And this would have been in Lal Dead's lifetime. She was born, they think, in early 1300s. And they believe she died. It's like somewhere in like 1370 to 1390. So this transition would have happened like from Hindu rule to Muslim rule would have happened during her lifetime. Mm-hmm. Anyway, the Muslim rule lasted for about 500 years until the Brits came in and took over. Then after World War II in 1947, the British pulled out. And this left the region in just utter cultural confusion. Because everybody was like, okay, well, what's the culture? What's the religion? Who do we belong to? What religion do we practice? India kind of came in pretty strong with their military and said, you guys can be your own thing, sure, but we're going to take control. And India was becoming more and more authoritarian. With their Hindu government, it's kind of today like a theocracy, I believe. And so India had a strong military presence there. But the thing is, because before the British took over, it was a Muslim ruled area for 500 years. Most of the people who live there are Muslim, practice Islam.
Yeah.
So for India to come in with their theocracy of like Hinduism and to be like, right, we're in control, you have to do this, this, and this, people obviously didn't like that. Also, yeah, Kashmir is an area that's really its own nationality. It doesn't fit into India. It doesn't fit into Pakistan or Afghanistan or China. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's its own nationality with 5,000 years of history.
Yeah.
So in the 90s, a lot of militant groups formed to resist the Indian government. And they turned to Pakistan for weapons and for help. And a lot of like violence and war broke out trying to take over. Just this cultural war, cultural differences. Yeah.
Wow.
And then it heightened in 2019, super recently. India officially revoked any Kashmiri autonomy.
Wow.
And they declare the end of the war and peace. But everybody in Kashmir, or from what I've read, it seems like people in Kashmir, it's like eerily quiet because they're like, peace. And yet it really just means like hope is dead. Hope is gone because they all want to be independent. And anyway.
Wow. That's really interesting.
Yeah. And I had no idea.
Yeah, me neither. Like, you know, I was going to say the same thing. I had no idea. And like, this is such like recent, like 2019, I feel like we would have heard about this. I don't even remember hearing anything about it. That's crazy. Like, it's all through like our lifetime.
Totally. It just shows the specific lenses that we're viewing the world through, or that we're like shown the world through. Yeah, because it was definitely, I guess it was like pretty massive. And if you were paying attention to it, it was everywhere. But yeah, it's not in the Western limelight. That's for sure.
Cycle. Yeah. That's so crazy.
Yeah. Wow. So that's the brief history of Kashmir. Mm-hmm. And it's important because Lal Dead was the bridge between Islam and Hindu. And both of them cherished her and they consider her a saint. And it's really sad that it's become so separated again, and that it's like they're even like, they even fight over, I don't know how popular she is necessarily, but some things that I read said that the two cultures will argue over who she belongs to. And that's unfortunate because her whole thing was neither in both.
Yeah. Yeah. So, wow.
Yeah. But let's get into her life. So Lalishwari was born into a high caste Brahmin family in Kashmir. And she's believed to have been educated at her father's home with Shaivite teachings and preachings. And she ended up becoming a disciple of Shiva. And it's believed that this is where her relationship with Shiva began, at her father's home.
Okay.
But she was married off at the age of 12, which was common for high caste families in that region at the time. Well, really, you know, across the world.
Yeah. That's fucking tragic.
It is pretty tragic. Different times for sure. But when she was married off, the family she was married into, the stories are that it was very abusive, particularly from her mother-in-law. There's a lot of legends and stories passed down about just like the mistreatment that she faced from her in-law family, and that her husband was kind of just like a pushover to his mom. And there's one story about her, like, she would be starved. Her mother-in-law would make the food. She'd give everybody a like plate full of rice. And with Lala, it would be a stone covered in a thin layer of rice.
What the hell?
And Lala would notice this, but she would never say anything. She would just eat the rice, clean the stone, and return it to keep the peace. There's another story. She would often meditate. She'd go out. It was her job to go out to fetch water from a local river. And because she always had this like spiritual inclination and she had this relationship with Shiva, she would always go out to find shrines and temples to meditate while she was going to fetch water. So it would take her a little bit longer to go than usual. And one day her mother-in-law suspected her of infidelity, and the husband believed this. So she came home one day with a pot of water on her head, and he struck it with his staff, breaking the vase. But the water supposedly remained frozen above her head until she was able to pour it where she intended.
Whoa.
And this got around, and she supposedly performed a bunch of miracles here, and her reputation was growing, and people would come to her for assistance and just to, like, be in the presence of an enlightened being.
Mm-hmm. But is that story abuse, why you say Pisces?
Not just that story, but yeah, that is
one of the reasons. One of them. Yeah, waterbender.
Yeah, for sure. Oh yeah, I didn't even think about that relationship to the water. That's true.
Or Aquarius too.
Oh yeah, the literal water bearer. Mm-hmm. True. Yeah, but this abuse, like, continued, and I'm not gonna get super into that because her, like, real story begins when she leaves this family.
Great.
So. Thankfully, she decides to leave this family at between the ages of 24 to 26. Sources vary on that.
She could just leave? Like, obviously, yeah. I'm sure divorce was not a thing. So she could just pick up and leave?
She couldn't unless she was going to become a disciple of a spiritual leader.
She's going
to devote
anyway.
Her life to God. Yeah. And she was already there. So she left to become a disciple of the spiritual leader Seed Shrikant, or Sed Boyu, who is a Shaivite. Mm-hmm. And she devoted herself to the god Shiva. So part of her religious education was to travel alone on foot. And she became a wandering ascetic.
Wow.
Which I listened to so many podcasts, watched so many videos. And they all said ascetic. And I was like, what is that word?
I don't know that word.
I didn't know what it meant. And I didn't know how it was spelled. So it was so hard to even Google to figure out what it meant. Anyway, for our listeners who maybe feel the same as me, I'm going to explain that.
For me, who also feels the same as you.
For Riley. An ascetic, it's spelled A-S-C-E-T-I-C. Which is basically like a saint, somebody who is a devout religious follower who denies all worldly, earthly things.
Okay. Now that you spelled the word, actually, I feel I feel like I've seen it, but I don't know that I've heard it said out loud. So, yeah, flop.
Yeah.
But.
So wandering ascetic. So she rejected all things of the world and just devoted her life to God, but didn't join like a convent or anything like that. She was just her own independent ascetic. And ultimately surpassed her guru in spiritual attainments. Wow. She became a Kashmiri mystic of the Kashmir Shaivism school of Hindu philosophy.
Wow.
And she engaged with both Sufism and Shaivism. Mm-hmm. So I want to explain a little bit about what both of those broadly mean.
Please do.
Shaivism is a disciple of the Hindu god Shiva. And Shiva's name means the pure one. It represents the self, the whole self that's inside man. And Carl Jung would later base a lot of his research on like Shaivism, but a lot of just Eastern, like Buddhism too, a lot of the Eastern philosophy and religions. But later, Carl Jung would coin this idea of Shaiva, or the pure one, the self with a capital S, meaning this universal self that we are all a part of. And rather than thinking of it outside of us, it can be found within us. So like this vast universal self is actually within you. And that, I believe, is the core idea of Shiva.
Cool.
And Shaivism. And then Sufism is also known as Tasawuf.
Okay.
It's a mystic body of religious practice found within Islam, characterized by a focus on Islamic purification, spirituality, ritualism, asceticism, and esotericism.
Wow.
So pretty similar. And that's the fun thing about all of these things that I learn and all of these, like, the mystic version of all these religions truly all comes down to the same idea.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And that they both have like the, like you use the word pure for both of them. They both have that mm-hmm. element of purity, which is really purity. Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And yeah, we'll get to this a little bit later, but like figuring out what the idea of purity really means. It is all pretty much the same. And it's interesting her take on it that we'll get into in a bit. But what exactly did she believe then? So we know that she engaged with Sufism and Shaivism and loved Shiva. She was a disciple of Shiva. But what exactly did she believe? This Kashmir Shaivism school of Hindu philosophy is a pretty specific school of thought. Mm-hmm. And this is what an article from the New Indian Press on the Kashmir Shaivism school of Hindu philosophy says. Says, it's the belief that all of creation is replete with one indivisible super consciousness called the Parama Shiva or Omkara, which means the supreme principle. But human beings do not realize this truth since their intellect is clouded by delusions induced by sensory or materialistic life. This makes them mistakenly identify with their worldly forms and roles, causing a great deal of suffering in the process and obscuring their real identity, which is one with God, who is formless, pure consciousness.
Wow.
Yeah, so I'm like, interesting. Hello, Hypatia. This is very similar to Neoplatonism and Christian mysticism mm-hmm. and Buddhism. Yeah. But Buddhism yeah. makes sense because Buddha was born into a Hindu family. So Buddhism really has Hindu roots, yeah, like a Hindu foundation.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I actually didn't either. I didn't either until looking into all this. Wow, which is also why I just love this podcast, because I learned so much beyond just the person.
Yeah, totally. Like about, yeah, the history of this region that's like still very, very relevant. And like that super. Whole. Yeah. And wow. Yeah, that's really interesting.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah, so okay, continue. Very similar to Neoplatonism, kind of what we were saying earlier, like all of these mystic traditions, these mystic beliefs across cultures seem to circle around the same idea.
Mm-hmm.
But the difference here between a lot of other mystic beliefs and her specific one, and I don't know if this was the same. I don't think this was even the same with like the Kashmir Shaivism belief system, but I think this was like her specific belief system, is that a lot of these mystic beliefs will reject the body and consider it as a block sitting in the way of our connection to the divine.
Mm-hmm.
But she, as you can see from her vox, glorifies the body as a path to the divine.
Yeah.
She celebrates the body as a holy vessel, as a tool to reach our creator. I think that's so beautiful.
Yeah, that's amazing.
That was something like with Hypatia, I remember when we were talking about her, I was like, well, I don't really agree with her here, because Hypatia was like, ignore the body. It has nothing to do with the divine.
Yeah. And I feel like, I mean, similarly with like Hildegard, who we covered in our second episode, like she also a saint, also a mystic, but Christian, like also really vibed with that.
Yeah, definitely.
Like how important the body is just in general and taking care of your body as a way to like honor yourself as a creation of God and stuff.
Of the divine.
Yeah, exactly.
Definitely, and I love
seeing that like script flipped too, because that's what I was taught growing up, like in the church is like the body is bad, ignore your body, like don't ignore your body
and like it's temptation,
exactly,
and like sin, and
like I was literally taught like gut feelings were not to be trusted, because that's like you should just ignore your body in every sense, and like
that's interesting.
Oh, it's just so honoring your body is so important, because I really do think that's the truth. When we shut ourselves like out of our bodies, like there's just so much destruction that comes from that, like not listening to your body, not taking care of it, not honoring how your body feels in like any situation. Like the body keeps the score vibes. Like,
yeah, definitely.
It's just so important. Yeah, for real. So
yeah,
it's just really,
it is really important, and it is really, really awesome to read. Yeah. I was thinking it's interesting that you were taught like don't trust gut feelings. I feel like I actually was raised in the LDS church with like, that is the Holy Spirit. Like there is like, there it's the still small voice is what they call it. Like, listen to the still small voice. He'll guide you. Mm-hmm. And that's something that's funny because that's returned to me in my recent, like, spiritual practices.
Yeah.
And I think mm-hmm. that was their version of intuition. But yeah, they just, totally. Like, painted it in a way that was, like, this is what the still small voice says to you.
Yeah.
But they For were, me... like, they were, like, listen to it. It will speak to you quietly, like, and give you personal messages. But at the same time, it was like, but the personal messages should be like this.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. It was very similar for me. And like the not listening to like your gut feeling, not following your heart. Like that was another thing that I was taught. It was like anytime you have like a feeling about something, you have to bring it to God before you make a decision or before you take any action. You have to consult God, which is just like, I don't know.
It's interesting because in a way, I'm like, yeah, but I think by trusting your gut, by understanding what your intuition is, that is communicating with God. That is consulting with God. Like when you're in tune with your intuition and you're listening to that and not your anxiety, like your intuition is God, in my opinion. That's like how trusting, they speak to you.
Yeah, especially when you're on like because the way that comes across to me is like you have to rely on an external source for validation of what you think and how you should act and whatever, which is like a control mechanism, which is what that felt like to me in that church. But like I think that like trusting your trusting yourself like innately is like is the goal. That should be goal. Like knowing that like your body and how you react to things is aligned with your highest self and your highest purpose.
Right. Yeah.
That's 100%.
I agree with that.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Religious tangent.
That was a good tangent.
Yeah, I was preaching a little bit. About that tangent.
You are preaching. But it was a good sermon. I appreciated
Thank
it.
Thank you.
So she believed that the body was essential. And importantly, she deviated from the prevailing Vedanta philosophy at the time, which said that the entire universe was Maya or illusion, and that the Brahman, the creative energy of the universe, was inactive. She instead practiced Kashmiri Shaivism, which held that the entire existing universe of matter and energy, or Shakti, was a manifestation of universal consciousness, Shiva, real and eternal. So this, I feel, is extremely aligned with my personal philosophy.
Yeah.
It extremely resonated with me when I read that, because a lot of mysticism, like Christian mysticism, is about believing that this world is an illusion and to trust in your mind, meaning like the mind of like the true mind, like source mind, and to see reality, and that this reality that we've created is just an illusion and you need to like not be distracted.
Yeah.
And I do feel like Buddhism gets a little bit into that as well. And I just really like the idea that this is all an expression of the light. Like it is very real. The lens in which we're viewing it is not the correct lens necessarily, but it's creation that we've created and it's very real and tangible and we need to honor it as the light of the universe.
Yeah.
And it's just more about seeing it through a different lens rather than it being an illusion, if that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely. That's really interesting.
So anyway, that's like an idea of her belief system, the Kashmiri Shaivism school of Hindu philosophy. So she wandered about the woods, enlightened and such, and she would recite these lyrical type poems that would come to her, or the Vox. And like I said, to me, these really feel more like scripture, but they are poems. And one very popular one is, "My guru gave a single precept. Turn your gaze from the outside to inside. Fix it on the hidden self. I, Lala, took this to heart and naked set forth to dance." So from this Vok, she's widely believed to have literally wandered around and danced naked, reciting her poems. That's like a pretty core part of the legend of Lala, is that she was naked all the time.
That's awesome. She said, "Which is awesome. My body, body is important." That's awesome.
Which I love, but yeah. I also wonder if that is a misunderstanding. Mm. Although, you know, power to her if that is true and she was naked. I think that is amazing.
Yeah.
But to me, when I first read this, it read more that she chose to walk completely vulnerable and raw. Yeah. Mm-hmm. After what her guru told her, that she was shedding all of her layers of worldly ideas and identities, and so she was naked. Like, to me, it feels like a metaphor. And there's just so many layers to what nudity could symbolize here.
Yeah, totally.
She mentions the nakedness of Shiva in other Voks, and that can be inferred to meaning that he's never hidden, or he's just constantly available to whoever seeketh. Mm-hmm. Mm. And I also think that naked creates an image that corresponds with the wild and natural and free-spirited state that she embodied.
Mm.
So I kind of feel like when she says that she's naked, she's saying that she embodies Shiva, who himself is in a permanent state of nudity, so to speak.
Yeah.
But maybe it was that and she was also naked.
Yeah, why not both?
She was really embodying her philosophy. And you know what? I guess that was kind of her whole thing, was embodiment of her philosophy.
Yeah, so. Literal embodiment.
Yeah, we'll say she's naked.
Yeah, why not?
I like it. And in regards to her frequent mention of dancing, and to relate this back to witches, I wanted to quote a research paper by Swati Tikku, titled Nuditas Virtualis, a Jungian analysis of Lal Dead's Vox. Which, first of all, when I came across that article, I was like, what?
Ding, 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 yeah.
Like, these are like all of my worlds kind of combining into a research paper.
Love that.
But they wrote, dancing is considered as one of the most ancient forms of magic, an art form that leads the artist to experience the divine in him. While dancing, he can experience his personality transforming, get a glimpse of the divine, and in fact have the elusive experience of emergence into the divine essence. When Lal Dead had a glimpse of her true nature, she was overwhelmed emotionally and spiritually. To express something which is as ephemeral and elusive as the first experience of her true self in words is impossible. She chooses to use the whole body as a medium to share her experience. So I really liked that because, she is described as dancing through the woods. And that's I think that makes a lot of sense that, when it comes to experiencing the divine, words do fall short.
Yeah.
And movement is really powerful. And I've felt that when I dance and you just have to process emotions and moving to get it out of you.
Yeah, totally. I've literally been – I was thinking – today, like an hour before we started this, I was like, I haven't like danced in a while. I need to like, and I'm like alone. And my like my partner is out tonight, and so I was like, maybe I'll just put on some music and dance before it. And then I ran out of time. But well, so maybe after this,
you can channel Lala. Party.
Yeah. Oh, channel I love Lala, that.
Dance.
Yeah.
And it's funny too, because I'm like, okay, in this way, she is relating back to Isadora Duncan, and I'm like, okay, we kind of have a theme
going. Everyone's connecting. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So fun that. To see.
Yeah.
My little mosaic. I know.
There was something. There's something about your person that relates to my person for next week too.
Oh, yay.
Well, that'll be fun to make that connection.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Anyway.
So her writing also prominent. Oh, yeah. You're going to love this part. So she's dancing. She's in her body, all of that. Her writing also prominently featured erotic innuendos, sexual metaphors, and analogies.
I'm just branded as this. You're going to love this. She also loved sex. Okay. I hope my mom doesn't listen to this.
No, just because you love a spiritual lady who's embodied and owns her sexuality.
And sex positive, so do I. Yes.
So do I. But I feel like that's like, I don't know, that seems like a niche of yours that you really resonate with.
You're not wrong, but that's really funny. You're going to love this. Erotica.
I mean that as a compliment.
I know. I'm just like, oh, I told my mom to listen to this podcast, and now I'm like, maybe she shouldn't. No.
My mom listens to every single one. Hi, Mom.
Oh, great. Hi, Mom. Hi, Jenna's mom.
Anyway. Okay. So her writing contains erotic innuendo, sexual metaphors, mm-hmm. such analogies and artistic bodily hedonistic symbolisms that are now tantric staples.
Okay.
At stark odds to the prevailing local Shaivite customs.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is really common in any religion also, relating like your relationship to the divine as sexual. Like, I think even like Hildegard did that, and she was a Catholic nun. So like,
which,
not the most sex positive religion to be in.
It's super interesting. I mean, that's like a whole other rabbit hole to go down, but.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
About how like. That euphoria of orgasm can be compared to spiritual euphoria. That's like a whole other super interesting conversation.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I could go off on a tangent right now, but I won't.
And sex magic and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we'll have to do another like mini episode on all of that.
On sex and spirituality. Yeah.
Sex and the soul.
True. Yeah.
Anyway,
go ahead.
So obviously her eccentric way of life was a bit alarming at first for the locals. But she had this reputation of being this like powerful, like magical person, but she was also shocking and her beliefs were opposing. But she rarely faced criticism. People would attempt to jeer or mumble as she walked by, but would quickly be silenced by her sheer indifference of them.
I love that. Unbothered.
And so Jane Hirschfield tells a story of children pestering her, making fun of her, likely for being naked and dancing and singing poems. And a silk merchant who was nearby came to her defense with bundles of cloth for her to wear. And so she was like, sure, okay, I'll take these and let's make an experiment out of it.
I guess.
So she took two bolts of silk of equal weight and she placed one on each shoulder and went on her way. And as she went through the day, each time someone ridiculed her, she would tie a knot in the cloth on her left shoulder. And each time someone praised her, she would tie a knot in the cloth on her right shoulder. And at the end of the day, she returned to the silk merchant and asked him to weigh the bundles again. She thanked him for his earlier concern, but also pointed out that as he could see for himself, nothing had changed. Whether blame or praise came her way, the bundles remained equal in weight.
Mm.
So that's like just that. Like a fun little parable. And I think it also gives her some personality or shows a little bit of her personality.
Mm-hmm. She's like, I don't care. I am unbothered.
And legend has it that around the age of 50, she was reciting her Vok for a crowd of people because throughout her life, she was just wandering and if people would ridicule her, she'd just continue on her way. But for the most part, she has a really positive reputation. She's said to like help travelers wandering through the wood. And she would just kind of recite her Vok and people would listen to her. So around the age of 50, she was reciting her Vok for a crowd of people. When she climbed into a large earthen pot and pulled another pot over her head. When she didn't emerge, spectators separated the pots and found that she had vanished.
Okay.
So there's no death story. Yeah, for real.
Oh.
There's no death story. She just vanishes.
So that's like.
That's her death.
That was the end for her.
That was the end.
Wow.
She just said, I'm out.
I thought she was just playing a trick or something.
No.
Okay.
She just said,
that's just it.
I'm done here. Wow. Bye.
Bye.
Yeah.
I'm out of here.
Yeah. So whoa. That's her life.
That's insane.
I know, right? And that's just, again, this is all oral legend. Like, this is all oral tradition passed down, because none of this was written when she was alive. And it makes sense because, you know, she was clearly not the kind of person. She wasn't trying to get followers or create a religion. So she wasn't writing anything down. It was all about her individual relationship with the divine. And she was just an example that people really admired and spoke about for hundreds of years, until finally somebody was like, I should write this down. So I want to talk about that and like her legacy and how significant she's been in those cultures. Her influence is known to have inspired many historical figures, Hindu and Muslim alike, including Mir Sayyid Ali Hamandi, an Iranian Sufi scholar and poet who recorded stories of her in his own verse during his travels to Kashmir, as well as the very famous Nund Rishi, who is the Islamic Sufi saint who founded an order known as the Rishi Sufi Order, which represented the syncretism for which Kashmir was once famous. So that word syncretism comes back. And again, Kashmir was this land that was a cultural and religious melting pot for everybody to feel safe and practice what they believed. In other words, she influenced a popular philosophy of the region that centered in peace and harmony. And again, she didn't found any movement or order of followers intentionally. She came and went alone. Her message was meant for the redemption of the individual soul. But there's another quote, says she was instrumental in the body of vernacular mysticism in the region, and a harmonizing influence and crucial link between traditional mysticism, the popular Bhakti movement, and Sufism. Lal Dead was a tantalizing oxymoron, a revolutionary reformer and an idealist empath. She made the esoteric accessible. So that's a funny combination of Pisces and Aries to me, too. The oxymoron, the revolutionary reformer and an idealist empath. But also Aquarius. The Uranus of Aquarius, the revolutionary reformer. An idealist empath is just like, that's how I would describe a Pisces.
Completely. That's so funny. Wow. How beautiful.
So she single-handedly rid mysticism of bearing privy to a particular creed, community, or language, or even faith. And she helped fashion Shaivism into a syncretic, all-embracing, queerness-welcoming sect. Somebody used the word queerness, and at first I was like, whoa. And then I did research trying to figure out where she talked about, like, gay people, and I think they just were referring to queerness as uniqueness, weirdness. But I would like to think that Lal Dead was for the gays,
probably. We're gonna go ahead and add that to her lore.
Definitely, since there's so much mysticism about her anyway.
It's likely to have happened.
But yeah, because of her, seekers no longer needed to rely on seers and high priests to liaise and initiate their way to God, as spiritualism became essentially a personal journey of self-discovery. She was also perhaps the first figure to effectively and popularly reconcile Abrahamic and monotheistic dharmic beliefs. So reconcile the, kind of what I was talking about earlier, the like Christian mysticism with the Eastern mysticism. Coming together. So pretty iconic person. I also feel like she's kind of been turned into a deity. Like, to me, reading about her, I felt like I was reading about like a god, in the sense of, because there's, it's a lot of her story is lore and myth. And people kind of put on her what they want from her. And also because of her vox, and this is the last little segment, but I want to get into her vox. I'm going to read a few of them and explain a little bit about those. So her vox, her verses are among the earliest compositions in the Kashmiri language and are an important part of the history of modern Kashmiri literature. They're often in first person and addressed to herself. in this way, they feel like a little lyrical journal entries to me.
Yeah.
But her Vox were first recorded in writing in the early 20th century. Oh, wow. She was alive in the 1300s, mm-hmm. and nobody wrote down her Vox until the 20th century.
Wow.
Okay. It was popularly passed down verses, like an mm-hmm. oral tradition that was extremely popular in the Kashmir region. In 1914, the superintendent of the Linguistic Survey of India commissioned a written copy by transcribing an oral narration from a well-known storyteller residing in Kashmir. Mm. So there was an official transcribed book where 285 Vox were attributed to her. They've since been translated to many different languages and in many different ways. And there's a recent compilation of her Vox called I Lala, which is translated by Ranjit Hosgodi. And I just bought it. It hasn't arrived yet, but I am so excited to dive into mm-hmm. it. It's going to be my new scripture. and it seems to be a pretty popular and widely praised edition as an accurate depiction of Lala's tone. Cool. Because it was oral tradition and passed down, mm-hmm. the translation varies from like copy to copy. And there's also a lot of, most scholars believe that not all 285 came directly from her, but mm-hmm. rather were kind of like channeled with her, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Like she possessed the minds of people, not like literally, but like she created the foundation of this idea and this style, and mm-hmm. people added to it as it continued. But it's all attributed to her because it begins with her.
Mm-hmm.
And in that way, that's also where I'm like, she feels like a deity.
Yeah, because, totally.
Like possessing the minds of people to write her words through them. I'm like, okay, she's writing a Bible. Mm-hmm. She's writing her own Bible, mm-hmm. even beyond the veil. And to me, that just was also a testament to her lasting impact and the strength of her cultural foundation. And in addition to the allure of her character.
Yeah.
So I'm going to read a few of these. These are some of my favorites that I found in my research. When the inner light lit up within me, off went the light outside. Let people abuse and taunt me, or let them shower petals and adoration. Nothing affects me. I am pure consciousness. Only when I can withstand censure will my inhibitions break down. Let my pride be torn asunder. Let not attacks bother me.
Mm.
And then another one. Gluttony gets you the best table in the town of nowhere. Fasting gives your ego a boost. Slaves of extreme learn the art of balance, and all the closed doors will open at your touch. I really liked that one because she's calling out everybody.
Yeah.
She's like, gluttony, like if you're being greedy, that gets you the best table in like the emptiest place. Like it doesn't feel good actually to have all of the physical things. But at the same time, fasting yourself, which is common of a lot of like spiritual seekers who will like deprive themselves of something in the name of spiritual journey. Mm-hmm. She's saying it just, all that does is give your ego a boost.
Yeah.
Makes you feel like you're spiritual. Doing.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And slaves of extreme learn the art of balance, and all the closed doors will open at your touch. That also feels like a very Aries moon. Like way of saying things. That's why I feel like the Aries moon makes sense, because these are all so like direct and blunt and not there's no fluff about them, to be honest.
Yep.
They're just like, this is what I think.
Yeah, totally. Maybe Aries Mercury.
There's no fluff, but they're still so poetic. And it's just really interesting. Another one. I'm towing my boat across the ocean with a thread. Will he hear me and help me across? Or am I seeping away like water from a half-baked cup? Wander, my poor soul, you're not going home anytime soon.
Mm.
That one, I feel like she's speaking to Shiva. There's also someone I listened to describing her Vox who was saying that they can be interpreted in so many ways, but that she thought the best way for them to be interpreted was the initial feeling you get when you read them or hear them, that it's supposed to be a personal thing, that you can say, oh, this means this, this means that, but that she felt it was supposed to be whatever resonated with you.
Yeah.
And I really like that as well.
Yeah. That gives me Aries Mercury, which is same as me.
Yeah, so. Same as you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's true.
Saying these things very, like, communicating her thoughts and feelings very bluntly, just not knowing any other way to, like, say them, just to, like, get them out. Like, this is what I think, this is what I feel. And then saying, like, the way that you should interpret them is just, like, however they initially hit you.
Right.
Like, that gives me Aries Mercury.
Definitely. I can see that for sure. Okay, there's two more that I wanted to read. This one. Oh, you dull pandit, you offer a living ram to a lifeless stone. It'll cover you in woolens and shield you against cold. It'll feed on water and natural grass and crumbs. Who has advised you to sacrifice a live lamb as an offering to a dead rock? I love that. It's again, she's like, what are y'all doing sacrificing these innocent animals? Like, who told you to do that? Because it wasn't the divine. Yeah, so that's a hot take, I guess, in that time, especially. Yeah, for real. And the last one I wanted to read is I, Lala. Oh, that's the other thing. This book is called I, Lala because a lot of her vox are addressed with I, Lala, which I think is really sweet.
Yeah.
But yeah, she says, I, Lala, entered the gate of the mind's garden and saw Shiva united with Sakti. I was immersed in the lake of undying bliss. Here, in this lifetime, I've been unchained from the wheel of birth and death. What can the world do to me? And I love that.
Wow. Yeah.
Beautiful. Yeah, so Lalishwari was an intrepid, unconventional, brave, spiritually enlightened woman, not dissimilar, I believe, to iconic spiritual leaders like Buddha or Yeshua, in a time where, in a time and place where women predominantly did not have a voice and remain largely silenced today. 285 of her vox survived 6 centuries of strictly oral recitation, not to mention her name is still commonly held with reverence in Hindu and Muslim homes alike. So the power of her words and message completely cut through the fabrics of space and time to exist here today, leaving a profound impact on whoever reads them still. To me, this is what truly colors the archetype of the witch, a deep understanding of one's personal power, whose abilities are sourced from within and beyond this world, recognizing and identifying not with oneself, but within the unity of all things. Deeply knowing the creator is to be accessed from within by any and all who desire to find it. Someone who harnesses it to promote unification, love, and awareness, who fully embodies what they teach.
Yeah.
I just felt like she just resonated with me so much. And I love that she's like this deity figure in my mind. I love that I'm about to get her book and treat it like my new Bible. And I do think that she gives me a very similar feeling to, like Buddha and Yeshua, or more commonly known as Jesus. And I think because she's a woman and of that region and of that culture is probably the reason why she's not as well known.
Yeah, for sure. But
I would be so honored to share a space with Lal Dead in our coven.
Welcome, Lala.
Welcome, Lala.
How sweet. What a fun story. What a fun person to add.
I know. I don't even remember how I found her. Truly, I have no idea.
That's the most fun part about this, too, is, like, I feel like when we were in the planning of the podcast, we both, like, kind of compiled, at least I did, like, compiled a big list of people, and I don't even remember at this point, like, where they came from or what drew me to them, and then I'll, like, go back through and be like, oh, who should I do this week before we record, and then I'm like, oh, and then someone will stick out to me, and I'm like, oh, and I start looking at, like, that's how my next one is. She was someone from my big list, and I was like, what drew me to her? And I look her up, and I'm just like, oh, wow, yeah, this is the person.
Yeah. So. I feel like I haven't even looked at that list. I always think I'm going to. Well, I always think I'm going to, and then I hear something about someone and write it in my notes app, and then I end up being really fascinated by them. This one is just in my notes app. I remember, I do not remember where I heard her name, but I remember writing it down, being like, oh, mystic poet. I probably want to do her.
Perfect. Yeah.
And then she was great. So do you have a hint that you would like to share about your person next week?
Yes, my person that I'm inviting to the coven next week is someone who I believe broke through a lot of barriers so that she could succeed in a time where really she shouldn't have been able to. And that's my hint. I'm not going to give any more away about her story, but that's kind of why I chose her, and we'll meet her next week. So what does our coven meeting look like now with all of our people?
Yeah, I thought about this, and I feel like Lala is with Isadora in the corner doing like a contact improv intuitive movement session.
Absolutely.
And they're kind of like both tuned into the ether in their own space.
Absolutely.
While
I see
Sally
it.
And Hypatia are still in a very heated discussion about the patriarchy.
And Hildegard is playing the music for them to dance to.
Yes.
This divinely intuned music.
Yeah.
And everyone's just on a very, they're all connected to the divine right now. Uh-huh. While Hypatia and Sally are probably arguing.
And I'm just
not paying
like,
attention.
Probably shitting myself that I'm in the room with all of them.
Yeah, for real. Well, welcome, Lala. We're very happy you're here, and we can't wait to dance with
you. Yes, we are.
Dance naked.
Cannot wait.
And write some poetry.
I'm so excited for that book to come in. So excited for that book.
Yeah.
Anyway.
You have to let me know how it is, and I'll get a copy.
I will. Maybe I'll send you a copy.
Okay.
Essential reading.
Yeah, true.
Okay. Right, see y'all next week. This has been another episode of Coven. Stars,
thanks for joining.
Production.
Thanks for joining our coven this week. You can find all sources used in the show notes. Don't forget to rate, review, and follow on all platforms, and like, comment, and subscribe on our YouTube channel. You can find us on Instagram and TikTok at coven.pod. Send us your magic moments and witchy recommendations at covenpod333@gmail.com. This has been a Stars Etc. production. Coven is written, researched, and edited by Jenna Scott and Riley Hale. Music by Jeffrey Boyle and Jenna Scott. Thank you.